So I say to the guy, young fellow working behind the counter, I go, look, I know it doesn't look it openly, but I'm going kind of a health kick. I said, do you have any popsicles that don't have sugar in them? And he goes, oh, sir, none of our popsicles have sugar in them. I said, just nothing, fruit, right? He goes, oh, no, we use organic evaporated cane juice. And I go, that sounds suspiciously like sugar to me. He says, no, sir, it is organic evaporated cane juice. And I go, this cane you speak of, has it a word in front of it? And he wouldn't bite. And I go, let me guess, it comes here in a bag, little white crystals? He goes, yes, sir. And I go, fucking sugar.
And so seriously, we've been waiting a few months. It's finally happened. So welcome, Tony V. How are you, man?
It's nice to be with you all.
So as we were just quickly chatting, fan for a very long time, Joe and I are just, you know, we've loved stand-up forever. You know, when we had Tobin on a couple of weeks ago, I started going to Nick's when I was in high school to watch comics. And you've been somebody that if I've come back, because I lived in L.A. for 20 plus years, if you were playing locally, I would try to go see. You're one of the people that really have made this region the epicenter of comedian, comedic talent, writers for the last five decades. So we are super excited that you're here today.
That all you just said right there is I'm still alive.
So consider this your eulogy. Let's go. All right, here we go.
Yeah, you can
double. Tony was a great man.
He was there, and now he's not.
And he owes me money.
But yeah. You know, my only request upon my demise, and I have my son on board with this, is I want my funeral procession to go through a car wash.
Yes. Oh my God, that would be fantastic.
I just think that'd be funny. And if I'm somewhere where you can see that, you know, because every car has to follow the car in front of it, with no questions asked.
And those little funeral flags would not make it through those brushes.
Yeah, no, like... no. I'm sure they have a collection of them. But then by the time that, you know, car 10 get up to the front of the line, and I'm assuming there'll be at least 10 cars, you know, the hearse will be coming out, and someone will have to look at somebody else and go, are we going through a car wash?
I got to tell you, like I said, Joe and I have been comedy nerds forever, and the best part about this podcast the last year and a half is having the funniest people we will be quoting that forever. I've seen your routine so many times, and now it will be in my head forevermore. Dude, that is fucking brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Okay, we're going to get the big question right out of the way. This is the most important question. Do you have any dick bucks?
I have none left over. I was very liberal with my dick bucks as, you know, I believe they were the forerunner to Bitcoin, you know,
commodity
that worked only in one place for one reason and was useless outside of that, you know.
And again, most of the people who listen to podcasts are friends of mine and Joe in California.
Do we need to explain it?
No, it's become such a thing that we talk. Okay. If you're over 40 and you're a comic who've done the show, right, a good
you know
part of it.
Right.
What is your favorite or what is your most bizarre Dick Doherty story? Because everybody over 40 who's done comedy has one.
Oh, man, there are so many. But, you know, here was the one. This was the one, you know, he booked the Ronnie Sabo room, the help me out here.
Not the lightship.
No, up on Route 93.
Oh, yeah, right by my house. I lived exactly a mile from there. Grill 93.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
River Road.
Grill 93, right, the Grill 93. And he booked that for years and years and years and years. I don't know how many years. But then they kicked him out, and the guy that ran the place started booking it himself. And so, you know, Dick was huge on calling in favors you know, under the guise of friendship. So we asked a bunch of us to not work for him, for the new guy. You know, he threw me out, you know, and I'm sure he was thrown out for a good reason. And you know, so I let it go and I go, yeah, okay. And then about, I'm going to say 8 months to a year later, I notice I'm the only one not working there. You know, all my buddies are working there. Everyone who worked for Dick worked there. Everything. So, you know, they call me and they go, look, you're the only one not working here. You know, what's the deal? And I go, yeah, okay, I'll take a date. So I take the date and then I get a call. Before it's even publicized, you know, I get a call from Dick. I can't believe you're doing this to me, stabbing me in the back. I go, Dick, I'm the only one not working there. You know, everybody else, I don't know how you and I are going to hold this guy up. To, you know, it's just me and you against the world. And he goes, well, if you had any integrity, and I go, wait a second, did you just use the word integrity? I go, this conversation is over. And I hung up, and then we had a beef for a little while, but we eventually worked it out.
Well, nobody, if you've done three shows or ran three rooms or a room for Dick three times, you were fired at one point. Like you fired everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And my favorite stories from people, he would call like 2 weeks later, like, that never happened. Like that conversation.
Right. He would rewrite history in the middle of of a rewritten history fact already. He'd start telling a lie and then tell a lie in the middle of that one. Oh. I don't think he knew the difference. I really didn't think he was one of those guys. Whatever his truth was, that was his truth.
And so many people we talked to got their start or did a lot of Dick shows because they had a working car and could go get a headliner who was had a DUI. Were you ever driven? Were you a driver or were you driven to the shows?
Yeah. No, listen, that's a Boston tradition. I think the first gig I ever got paid for was because one of the headliners, when we used to do showcases back then, there'd be three people, and one of them was hungover and only wanted to do half his set and offered me half of his money if I drive him. But I go, yeah, sure. You know, and that's how it gets, you know, and I, you know, you have a pretty good set and then they start offering you work. That's really how it happens. Yeah.
I got to ask, because you're one of the people who actually did sets at the Don Ho. Was it as insane as
Ding
people
Ho.
Talk?
Ding, yeah,
Ding
yeah.
Ho. Ding Ho. Sorry. Yeah. Don Ho, a little different.
He's a tiny bubbles guy.
Both of them delightful, but are the legendary stories half as true?
100%. They're not half as true. We've actually sanitized them for general consumption.
We're getting the PG-13 version.
Yeah. It was like Caligula's birthday party every night.
I mean, the stories of like literally cops and robbers, everybody in there, you know, there was no difference.
No, the doors would lock after the show. This is my favorite story to tell about that. And it doesn't give, you know, it doesn't hurt anybody, but it sums up what the time was. We used to do shows there, Tuesday through Sunday, right? And Monday was dark. And so you'd do a show on Sunday night, then the doors would close and we would play cards in the back room, you know, and whatever. And we're playing cards one night and we're just playing and playing and playing. And then somebody taps me on the shoulder and they go, Tony, you're on next. And I go, what do you mean? We just, you know, it's Sunday night. We're done. He goes, it's Tuesday.
Oh, my God.
I go, all right. I'll be right with you.
And help me understand the timeline between when you hung up your coat as a social worker to your losing track of days in the back of the day-ho.
Well, and as I like to say, the hours agreed with me more. I was working in the mental health field for a while, and it was one of those moments in your life where you go, I think a lot of people initially do that because they think they're doing some good in the world, and trying to help out. Then I realized the people I was working with were just as scummy as everybody else. And I go, it doesn't really matter, I guess, where you work, as long as you're true to yourself. And that's when I made the leap.
When I found out that was your background, it's interesting because after I saw you, my wife had just gone to a show where there's some older comics, and this is a couple years ago when the whole pronoun things kind of came out, and she was, her big takeaway was that there was a couple comics who were like, they weren't making a judgment either way. Their take was, I'm too old to learn new things.
To learn these things, yeah.
And my wife, who's the funniest, like Joe will tell you, she's one of the funniest people. She's like, gosh, I hope he doesn't have to move, because if he has to learn a new zip code, that guy will be fucked. But when I saw you, and it's like, you're not like this woke comic. You never went to sleep. Your take on it, and I don't like to do guys' routines, but just your little bit on that, I was like, oh my God, that is smart. It calls attention to this is out there, but you did it in such a way that nobody could be pissed at you.
No, and believe it or not, some people have been. I mean, the whole thing has swung around where I over-explain my jokes now because of what I look like. if I say a word in a joke that I think someone's going to take exception to, I will go, you understand that's not the object of the joke. That's just to get me to the punchline about this.
Nothing makes comedy funnier than a disclaimer. Oh my God.
But, you try to find some humor in that. And I've always been that way, a little bit against type, for an old straight white guy. It's, right. I'm a pretty liberal thinker. I never dismiss anything. Even, back when I was just talking to somebody about this last night, even, way back when people started talking about gay this or this guy's gay or that guy whatever, I go, what's it matter? If it doesn't, if it doesn't affect you, it doesn't affect you. Like, it came out that one of the newscasters was gay, and I go, if I can't understand him because he's blowing somebody, now it's my problem. it's not my problem, because all I want to do is listen to the news.
Right.
My take has always been, how do these guys over there having sex affect my wife not blowing me?
That's plain and simple.
I think the best take, and I hate giving credit to somebody awful, it's like, I remember, and this is how goofy I am. I think it's in a 1959 album where Woody Allen's like, he's not gay, but it does double your chances of a date on a Friday night.
it all goes back to Lenny Bruce, who was and that's where I got my sensibility from is, it's more about punching up than down.
Yep.
It's like, guys who make fun of homeless or this one or that, and it's going, yay, what do those people ever do? Let's talk about the people that, that are really ruining things.
Because honestly, we're middle-class white straight guys. It's our turn to take our beating. It's our turn to get the shit slapped out of us.
Yes, we've had a nice run. If you didn't do anything with your privilege by now, you're not done.
Yeah.
And it is It was great to see when you did. Like I said, so my wife had just seen another show with some guys, you know, your age, like we're a couple years apart. And she, and when she saw you, she's like, oh my God, that's just, so not every guy who looks like that talks like that. Like,
things like know? That, right.
You know,
and that's when I think I get away with some of the stuff I get away with because I don't look like I should know stuff.
Yeah.
So don't ask Tony. He's not going to know that.
Right, right. That day. He can't. He didn't say that word, did he? Yes. Yeah.
So
and I think the bit you're referring to is about my daughter.
Yes.
Yeah. When I will pointedly say, you know, I have two kids, a boy looking one and a girl looking one. I don't know much about them. I know they don't live with us. That's all I know. I don't know where they live, but they don't live with us. You know, I certainly don't know how they identify. It's none of my business. I know my daughter doesn't like to identify as my dog.
and that's just like whatever side you want to be on. If you want to be on the, hey, I'm not a complete asshole side or the asshole side, that's right. A funny joke. And right. You're the punchline, you know?
And I'm the punchline, yes. Yeah, and I'll often say it, that, and I think that's more of a me thing than the gender thing.
So we're going to get into the big thing, the big show, the biggest show you probably did. You will be remembered in the 100-plus year history of all the Game 7s that were lost at Fenway Park. You are the first guy to take a mic and tell jokes at Fenway Park.
Yes, but yes, I was. And let me say this, all due to the kindness of Bill Burr. You know what I mean?
Yep.
He could have had, you know, he could have had juggling cats on before him. He could have had.
No, they had this thing. They had a booking. They were in Atlantic City. He called them.
They were busy, right. You know, he could have had somebody reading the label on a maple syrup bottle and it wouldn't have mattered. And he was very kind and asked me to open, therefore making me the first comedian to ever work at Fenway. But make no mistake, it was because of him. No one came.
Well,
you know, maybe six people came to see me. And I think my wife left halfway during my set.
She came in after. I've seen this before. Yeah.
Well, if you look at the whole thing as a ball game, I guess you consider it.
But that being said, it's pretty otherworldly, man. I mean, it's you have to make a decision on how you're going to play it. And, you know, I think a lot of people, their instinct would be, you know, go out and cheerlead. Welcome to Fenway. It's a blah, 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 you know, and me being me, I go, you know, I'm just going to do my act. And I wrote a couple of things for the event. And, you know, I got to say it went pretty well. I mean, so much so to a point where I think I was ad-libbing with section 107, which was across the field and up two decks. And at one point I turned to do it a little aside. And in my own head, I go, the ball's on you. Ed Living at Fenway Park. What's wrong with you? You know, but you know, your instincts had to go with your instincts. And it was pretty good. And I think I opened that set by going, listen, I'm already a trivia question. You know, let's see how it's going to be remembered. And it was pretty good. Yeah.
So you had another big event. No, yeah. Well, I mean, he had you host because, I mean, what was your relationship going back when he was coming up?
Well, as we've been hinting at, you know, he's younger than I. And when he first started, I was, you know, hosting and headlining shows and stuff like that. And a lot of my contemporaries really didn't take the time to talk to young comics. You know what I mean? They just didn't have the time for it. It wasn't what mattered to them or whatever. And I would take the time to speak to people. And I offered him some advice, which he claims is the best advice anyone ever gave him, which was get out of Boston. You know, don't. You know, you're only going to go so far here. Your path lies somewhere else. And when you see something in somebody, I go, oh, this kid's got it. He's got heart. And that's what I look for in a cop. You know, it's coming. it's coming from the heart, not just the lips.
But that's a great thing when you see that, like how many people in your position, you know, put a hand down to help guys like him up. And now he doesn't forget that. And I really, you know, it's like same thing. I saw, Mike Donovan on Joe Rogan when Mike Donovan's latest book came out, you know, here's Joe Rogan.
I think Mike Donovan's written like 140 books.
This one was about comedy. It came out like last February, maybe about a year ago. Fact that Joe Rogan didn't forget that he probably got some advice and Mike was probably great to him. And it's just really great. Now, this Fenway Park thing, this was the second big event you were part at Fenway Park because the town premiered at Fenway Park in 2010.
I've done a couple of things there. that was so much fun. I have a small part in the movie The Town, and they premiered it where the casting crew sat on the third baseline, and then they had a screen, like a drive-in theater-sized screen that went from third base to home plate. And then we all got to watch the premiere there, you know, at Fenway. And it was just, it was pretty fun.
I'm bummed because about three, four episodes back, we had a very close friend, a mentor of mine, a person who's been a mentor for me for 20 years, Bill Fay, who created Legendary Pictures. And I got invited to that. He called. He goes, "Hey, we're doing," because he knows I'm from Boston. I mean, we've been really close for 10 years. And I was doing a road thing. I managed a NASCAR at the time, so I was doing a NASCAR and NFL thing. But the fact that was at Fenway Park, that had to just be just the coolest thing.
There was a point where it was, I mean, we were so wrapped up in it. And, you know, everybody worked on it, was in it, but nobody had seen the finished product. And it was during the if you know the town at all, when they hit the armored car in the North End, and the famous close the bridge, and they go through the escape in the North End to get back to Charlestown. And I'm sitting there, and everybody is just dead silent. I mean, it's 60 feet tall and 100 feet wide. It's just crystal clear and beautiful. And I'm watching and I go, if you had to get out of the North End, that's exactly how you'd have to do it.
Right.
Like they paid so much attention to that detail. It wasn't just random streets. You know what I mean? I knew exactly where they were and where they had to turn, and they did it. And after that, when they get back, and the button on that scene is when they pull back into Charlestown and the cop's across the street and he looks at him and then just turns away and drives off.
Yeah.
When they're in the nun costume.
Love that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing that takes you out of a movie than not like if you're from Boston and you're watching a Boston movie, you're looking at the directions. You're like, wait a second. He can't get to, you know, Southie 10 minutes.
He goes in the tunnel. And here, and he ends up in Newton. Wait a second.
That Dunkin' Donuts isn't there. I know where that Dunkin' Donuts is.
That one doesn't have a drive-thru. That's bullshit.
Right. Nobody else in the world knows.
You know? No,
we're still Boston. We're going, that never happened.
Right. So, you know, even
they did it.
No. Yeah. Because they cared. I was living on the other side of the world in 2014, and I would watch Patriot games at 3 a.m. Some people would watch it with me on the compound. I would get so mad every time. It's like here's a shot overhead of Foxborough, cut to the Sakin Bridge. And I always felt compelled to tell people, yeah, that's about an hour away.
It's not even close.
You know,
if you're on the Sakin Bridge 10 minutes before kickoff,
and The Towns is one of my favorite movies. I mean, because, you know, Boston kids love it.
It's great.
One of my favorite lines in the history of movies is when Ben Affleck walks in and he says, "You got to come with me. We're going to hurt some people, and you can't ask me any questions." You know, whose car are we taking?
And the thing that makes that scene was Jeremy Renner's pause.
Yeah.
that Woogie got in his eyes. He was actually like thought about it for like exactly the time he'd go, yeah, whose car are we taking? Yeah. Yep.
One of the things that Joe, you know, sent me when we, yeah, we're going to talk to you. He found Space Force. That was really fun.
Yeah, Trace Gatto's.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a fun little short.
Those guys. I love those guys. And, you know, they put their all into it. I did another project with them called Salesmen with Orlando Baxter and Corey Rodriguez and Will Noonan, among others. And, they do it for a nickel, but it looks like $1 million. They really know their stuff.
Yeah, I was watching Rope-A-Dope as well. You were good in that too. Yeah. Yeah, that was funny.
Well, that you know it is like the barrier to entry. Just what you can do on your iPhone now. All kidding aside, like. I sort of went to film school in '93. I say sort of because it was Fitchburg State, and I really didn't go.
They can offer classes in film, sure.
But the cameras now on your phone, the edit software, the special effects you can do with a walk out of the store with a laptop. Yeah. It's absolutely amazing. No, but that was really fun. Misfits and Monsters. That was a really fun series.
Yeah. I had a couple of those. You know, just to harken back to the thought you just had, I bet you we're like five – you know, I'm going to say like 3 to 5 years away from being able to film something on Ring doorbells. Yeah. Nothing but Ring doorbells. That'd make a great movie. It's called Are You In Me?
I wouldn't be surprised if somebody's doing that now, because I know there's a bunch of TikTok people who do shows on Ring doorbell. Like they, you
on
know.
Ring, oh, okay. See, I'm dead now. Yeah.
I think the NSA is producing something on Ring doorbells right now.
Yeah, but Misfits and Monsters was my good friend Bobcat Goldthwait, who I will be with at Off Cabot next weekend.
Two nights, Friday and Saturday.
Speaking of Bobcat, Jacques, do you want to bring up one of your favorite movies of all time?
I don't care when I say this. I don't go a day, you know, if we ever get to talk with Bobcat, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that guy. You know, do you remember when you were in the Beatles? But Shakes a Clown, I will go to my deathbed saying, I stand by the tagline of the movie. It is the Citizen Kane of alcoholic clown movies.
Yeah. You know, Martin Scorsese saying its praises in a director's magazine. I think it was Directors or whatever. He was being interviewed, but he said it was a really good movie. I think he said great. I'm not 100% sure. And I later on when he was doing the other Boston mob movie there,
Departed.
But I got to audition with Martin Scorsese.
Wow!
And they initially hired me, and then moved the production to New York and had to hire all local guys there. Mm. But I did like a half hour improv with Scorsese, which is like, you know, to me is like one of the coolest things that's ever happened, regardless of it not going anywhere. I mean, to sit in a hotel room with Martin Scorsese and to, just improv with him and stay with him, the whole time was great. And then after we done, we were laughing and whatnot. And, I said to him, I go, he goes, he's looking at me, he goes, oh, you're in Shakes the Clown. I said, yeah. I go, and if I'm not correct, you say it's one of the best movies of all time. He goes, no. I said, it's a really good movie. and because of this reason, it invents a world. It invents the rules for that world. And it lives by those rules for the entire length of the film.
It's you have, everybody has these sayings that they pick up somewhere. Joe and I have 50 things that we speak our own language sometimes, but with my wife and I, or anybody, if I go to the store and I have ice cream and she doesn't want me to, the kids to know it, I'll say the dolphins are in the jacuzzi, like that. And if she's like, if I'm cooking something, it's like, and I pick up the ladle, she can taste, I'm like, body of Binky, like always. There's like so many lines from that. But no, that's a great thing about you've been part of so many of these, you know, great moments. Did you have a background? You know,
the dolphins are in the jacuzzi. It was when I was living in L.A. It was the password to get Cuban cigars at one of the cigar stores. But you have to say the dolphins are in the jacuzzi.
That's fantastic. And now I have a backstory to that. But is it was acting on the – when did acting become part of the portfolio?
Well, you know, it wasn't my first love, and I, you know, was not, you know, classically trained as an actor. I did some work in New York at HB Studios when I was living down there and stuff like that, when it became obvious that, you know, hopefully sitcoms were going to be in my future or whatever, you know, and did some fine tuning, but it was more of a sidelight. It was always stand up that was the draw for me, the live performance. But it sort of happened by mistake. I was out in L.A. I did a showcase, and there were a bunch of casting directors there, and you know, they'd call you in for this or that. You know, I did the single guy. I did Anthony Clark's show, Boston Common. I had an episode of Seinfeld, and it all sort of went from there. And then when I left L.A., when my kids were being born, I got a job on a show called The Brotherhood for Showtime. I was a recurring character. And that's when I go, oh, this is fun. You know, when you're sort of gainfully employed. But I owe a lot to Bobcat as well. He, you know, got me the start. He recommended me for One Crazy Summer that I had a couple of lines in, and then it which goes back to 1986, I think. And then, you know, it sort of went from there.
Well, it's funny because, you know, just like you give advice to Bill Burr, and years later, you know, he returns the favor, so to speak. It's funny how many comics from this area, quote unquote, made it, and their first instinct is like, who can I pull into this? So, you know, with Dr. Katz, like how many comics, like you, like Joe just sent me the clip of you and Dr. Katz, which is a show we love. Rescue Me. I mean, it's funny because, again, Joe and I falling down this rabbit hole of comedy. And now, you know, I'm friends, like Jim McHugh puts me up on a regular basis. And the best thing is I get to hang out with, you know, comics who I would pay 20, 30 bucks to see, but all of them almost, you know, it's like Ken Rogerson, you go down the list and they all have their, oh, my episode of Rescue Me was this. Oh, when I did this, and it's all that. It's like one of you guys gets a show and then.
And everybody's involved. Yeah. I mean, and you know, that, listen, cause that's how, you know, the Boston scene started. The comedy scene, there was nothing here but us and doing stand-up. There was no end game. There was no, we're going to do this and then I'll get discovered. You know, that happened when they tapped Stephen Wright for the Tonight Show as the first of, you know, a group of us that we all started going, oh, there's something beyond, you know, going to Framingham and Bellingham and, you know, out to Shrewsbury or whatever to do.
So you were out in LA. So now, here's because we're all over the map. Or I'm all over the map. Sorry. Your dad, your kids in comedy. How did that came about? Is that or was that, you know what? It's gonna suck, but give it a shot.
You know, we all have our regrets, and you know. I think part of the problem, and my son Gus is he's really funny. He's got his own, you know, we're nothing alike. you know, we make each other laugh, but for not because we're similar, you know. And, you know, the thing I think that happened was, you know, I started bringing him to comedy shows when he was like eight. You know what I mean? So he was around it, and he was around all these people. He never, you know, thought it was anything other than odd about it. You know, when I started, we were freaks if you wanted to do stand-up comedy. You know, but by the time, you know, it got to him, it was like it's a viable way to get seen, you know. And he went to Emerson and all of that. And, you know, we only let him see the good parts of it. Like, you know, every time we'd go somewhere, you know, we'd get seats to, you know, front row of the Celtics game. We'd go to the Legends box, you know, in the for hockey, you know, just because or whatever. And I think he associated, you know, everything good with stand-up. I tried to talk him out of it. I really did.
Well, if only there was the ding-ho, you know, like if you could bring him to the ding-ho.
If he saw that, it would have been, well, you know, it would have been a whole other thing. But he's a good kid. He's very funny.
No, my favorite, it was great. You told the story at the show we did. Some festival thing, by some twist of fate, you went on before him, and he got up.
Oh, yeah. It was Jim McHugh. No, it was Jimmy Dunn at the Hampton Beach Comedy Festival. And whoever made the lineup put me on before Gus. And it was the week of Fenway was coming up the next week, you know. And my son gets up and he goes, "Wait a second, that fat fuck is opening for Bill Burr." He goes, "Well, he's opening for me tonight." And everybody turns and looks at me like I'm going to be mad. And I just go, "That's my boy." You know, it's as viable as anything right now.
Right. Yes. 100%.
The world is so fucked in the head that it's as stable as anything.
Yeah.
And you know, as I said before, it was an outlier. It was a lunatic if you wanted to do this. Now it's just like a career choice. My favorite thing now is because of the nature of stand up. You know, there's no real criteria. You don't need a diploma or a piece of paper that says you're qualified. You literally just have to call yourself a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And you are one.
Well, that's it. You know, as long as you understand, Dante the Comic, a guy in LA, you probably crossed paths with him before. He's been in the business 40 years. He always talks about this. The only reason you do comedy is because you have to. If you're going to do stand up because I'm going to get rich, I'm going to get a show, I'm going to do this, that's not going to happen. But if you, it has to be one of those things where you can't not do it.
Right. It's got to be organic. It's got to come from the heart. It really does. Or, you know, I mean, listen, you know, Sebastian Maniscalco, who I take nothing away from his accomplishments. Let me start there. But do I find him funny? Not in the least.
You know, no.
If you can write a new hour every day because you went to the dry cleaner, there's something wrong.
Oh, no. And that's, as a parent, that's the other thing. You know, it's like we you know, with music, it's the same thing. It's like, just because you don't like this guy doesn't mean they're not really good at what they do. It's just not for you.
It's not for you. It you know, it's what we, you know, sort of dance around earlier in this podcast. You can recognize something in somebody that you don't have.
Right.
And appreciate that, you know, and you can also smell bullshit from a mile away.
So in circling back again to the whole mentoring and stuff, you've been teaching. How long have you been teaching? And is that something you enjoy?
You know, I've been with, I wrote the curriculum for, if it can be such a thing, for Laugh Boston's Laugh University stand up levels 1 and 2. And to say you can teach somebody comedy is a falsehood. To say you can bring out the funny in somebody is completely doable. And I probably had 5 or 6, it's been years now, got interrupted by the pandemic. So we started a little bit before then. It's something. What I like to do is answer the questions for people that might have in 6 weeks, the questions that took me 15 years to figure out on my own.
Right. No, that's
so it just gives them a little leg up. Yes.
Well, so I know some of your students, and there's two things I wanted to touch on with that. Women in comedy, I want to circle back to at one point, but like Lauren Sims, who's been on our show, she was a student.
Very fun.
Oh, she's incredibly funny. She is incredibly funny. And when she talks about your class, I know lots of people who took different classes. And again, the better teachers seem to be the one that tell you the not this is how you write a joke thing, but this is how you be a comic thing. And she had talked about that you're about, hey, if you're going to go on stage with a hat, you're the comic who goes on stage with a hat. If you are this, be this type thing, which is different.
You got to know what you're selling and how to sell. Yes. And that's all. Listen, and I teach to a very specific form of stand-up comedy, which is live performance. You know what I mean? There's a lot of ways to be funny. Writing, TikTok, all your platforms or, improv, this, that. I teach a very specific skill, which is live stand-up comedy. And I tell people immediately that this is just the beginning. You don't do 6 weeks and go, okay, here's your diploma, you're a comedian now. it puts you on the runway to not embarrass yourself when you go to showcases and start building a career.
So you've been in comedy since he started telling jokes in Boston. What are the biggest changes you've seen over the last decade or so?
Well, I think every generation puts its own stamp on it. Whatever came before it is old school, and the trend now just seems to talk about your medications and your neurosis.
Guilty.
which is fine. If that's what people relate to, then that's fine.
But I mean, rest in peace, Richard Lewis built a career on that, right?
Oh my God. No, he was one of the best. I mean, I was such a fan of his. I got to work with him many times. Someone said, "Did you know Richard Lewis?" I go, worked with him many times. Can't say I knew him.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
100%.
Yeah. But the first time I saw him, we were doing a college. We were doing Brandeis University. And, I was really excited to be working with them. It was Carol Leifer, Richard Lewis, and Jeff Altman. And I was going to MC the show. And I walk into the dressing room, which was like the lunchroom or whatever. And Richard Lewis is literally laying on the table, holding his head and going, I don't know if I can do this. I'm sick as a dog. I don't know what it is about me. And I go, oh, fuck, it's not an act. and that's it's just a heightened version of who he actually is, and I think that makes the best comedy.
No, it's Jeff Altman is somebody Joe and I talk about because we've done more than one deep dive on Pink Lady and Jeff.
Oh, Pink Lady and Jeff, yeah.
But I also...
weird concept. It was him and two Asian ladies, right?
And the whole thing is they were like playing stadiums in Japan. And when the producer brought them over here and said to Joe, who produced that show?
I said Marnie Croft.
He's like, do they speak English? Oh, yeah. They told him 100%.
Yeah. And then the first question is, do they speak English? Yes. Did they speak English? No.
Not a word. Just a couple of weeks ago, Joe and I watched the episode where Jerry Lewis was on it. And I tell you, it was great. But Jeff Altman, who put out an album when I was in college, I'll Flip You Like a Cheese Omelet. I haven't heard that record in years. I think I could quote it. What did John Tobin call Jokey-Okey? Jerry?
Yeah, well, Jokey-Okey.
Jokey.
Karajokey.
Karajokey.
People's jokes, yeah.
If I was going to do Karajoki, I could get up and start to finish do how, you know, I'll Flip You Like a Cheese Omelet album by him. Was he great? Right. Yeah.
They really tried with him. He was a contemporary of Letterman's too. And they really tried to do something with him and could never figure it out. And he wasn't the nicest guy to me. I'm going to stop myself.
No, see, we always love those stories. It's like the Jerry Lewis stories. He was always nice to me, people, you know, right. Was their nice way of saying, yeah, we know he's an ass.
This guy wasn't so nice to me.
Who were the guys, like, who were some of the heroes that came through town that you opened for or that you were on the road with? Who were some of the big names that you were like, I can't believe I'm working with this person?
Well, you know, I filled in for Jerry Lewis at the Palladium in London.
Wow.
Yeah, he got sick. We're doing a show. I was traveling. I was with Goldthwait. We were traveling around London, and Goldthwait was doing the show for a thing called Turning Stone. It was a drug rehab at the Palladium, which is, you know, like the richest of the, you know, the fucking queen goes there and whatnot.
Those in the balconies clap. Those in the front rattle your jewelry, I think was the
yes,
John Lennon.
Yeah.
Club.
Yeah. It was Bobcat, Nemo Phillips, and Jeff, Paul Provenza, Jeff, what's his name? One of the Jeffs. And just a who's who, and then they had a bunch of British comics that were, you know, famous there and everything. And we were just doing shows around London. You know, I was doing like the Slug and Lettuce and the Pig and Whistle and the Fox and whatever the pubs were, you know, and they had a great comedy scene. We had a lot of fun. And then we'd go to do this show. I meet Jerry Lewis, which was a big deal. And he was very kind. And but come showtime, he had somehow fallen ill, and it this was a big deal. They had a 30-piece orchestra on stage. They had flown in a mime from France, you know, to give him this award, and this it was all built around Jerry Lewis. And he just wouldn't. They flew him over, and all this, and he wouldn't take the stage for some reason. He was. You know, he had fallen ill. I don't know if he passed out or whatever. And the whole show was like 2.5 hours worth of show. And I was sitting in the second row just watching the show. And the MC freaks out. Goldthwait runs on stage and sort of rescues the show and says, look, Mr. Lewis has become unwell. We're not going to just leave you like that. And he looks in the second row and he goes, hey, Tony, you want to do a set? And I go, yeah, sure, why not? You know, it was the same thing. I got up out of my seat, walked around, Goldthwait did a few more minutes. He introduced me. I go on. I got Jerry Lewis's band behind me playing, and I closed the show.
Yeah. Incredible.
That is. All right. That's the end of the podcast because we're not going to top that. No, we actually have to keep going because speaking of awards, you know, you're getting an award from the Boston Comedy Festival in its 24th year.
I found this out. Yes, I'm going to get a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Boston Comedy Festival. And our good buddy Jim McHugh, which I am honored about. Yeah, you know, I hope it doesn't mean I got to stop. I mean, I hope I'm not going to be dead in 6 months.
Right. Yeah, I know. Like, first of all, we opened with a eulogy, and now you're getting a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Right.
Better get the car wash ready, is what I'm saying. Right.
I don't know the history of every comedy festival, but this is 24 years in the city where second to none. I mean, you know, the bigger cities, L.A. and New York. Yeah, most of the people who came out of there came from here first. So, I mean, this festival is huge. I know you've been a part of it. I know. But that's a pretty big thing that, you know, you're getting this year.
I'm very honest. It's so funny. This is just my life. You know, Jim calls me and he goes, are you working on, the March 30th or 29th or whatever it is? And I go, geez, I'm booked in Hayville, you know? And he goes, oh, well, we were going to give you the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Boston Comedy Festival. And I go, well, okay. You know, yeah, I guess, you know. So, you know, and I go, no, really, I'm honored and stuff like that. I'll see if I can get out of it. Like, I'm not going to get out of it, right? So I call the guy that books it, and I go, listen, I'm getting honored by the Boston Comedy Festival on the night of Haverhill. You know, what? I don't think I could double them up or whatever. He goes, I'll give you 50 more bucks. And I go, I don't think you're getting it. I go,
but they're dick bucks. But they're dick bucks.
They all come full circle. So I'm very honored about that. I'm very happy. You know, I wish I had accomplished more to have a lifetime achievement, but you know, it is what it is.
So my big takeaway is, in case the 50 bucks is too good, Joe should be in the second row with a set ready to go to fill in for you, like you did Jerry Lewis at the Palladium.
Yes.
Okay.
In case I can't make it back from Haverhill in time.
Is it a VFW or Knights of Columbus in Haverhill?
It was some function. It's some function hall. It is one of those. I don't know which.
You know, that's a running. That's another thing we ask every comedian. It's like, okay, you can only pick one. VFW Knights of Columbus. It's a Sophie's Choice of New England comedy.
I gotta go. KSC.
Mm. Yep.
You know, that is my yardstick. That's my measuring apparatus for how you know you're at the tail end of a mediocre career. When somebody says to you, they go, hey, do you want to work the Knights of Columbus in Skowhegan, Maine? And you go, no, that's fine. And then they go, do you need the address? And you go, no.
Oh, that is delicious. Tony... Joe, do you got any more questions for the legend?
No, I think Tony's had enough of us. You know, he's not even in the country right now. He's in an undisclosed location, but let's just say it's sunny and warmer than where we are right now.
I just got out of the Caribbean. Oh. And I lost my clip-on sunglasses. That's the biggest tragedy that happened to me today.
I'm sorry.
Is there a comedy thing down there? Is that where I'm thinking there's a pipeline that the Boston comics all go down there and do a week at a time?
It's Aruba Ray's comedy club. Ray Ellen was a Boston native. And again, it's just one of those happenstances. He's much younger. And when he first started doing open mics, I was the first guy to MC a show he was on. And you know, sort of encouraged him to keep going too. And he was, he was too young to get in the clubs. We used to have to hide him, you know, at the foot of the stairs at the Comedy Connection in Faneuil Hall. And then we'd go, you go on stage, we're going to escort you to the stage, you're going to do your set, and then we're going to escort you out of the building.
Oh, that's super cool.
And we'd have people stationed all the way along the way to make sure he'd get on and get out of the building all right. And he remembered that after many years and invited me down. And Lenny Clark and I came down, the first guys to ever work here from Boston.
Oh, that is fantastic. Again, the circle of like helping people out, and then when they are in a position and call.
And I'm talking 25 years later, he remembered, you know, and he goes, yeah, I'll take Tony, sure. And, you know, we've gotten to be friendly, and it's not bad duty.
So this will drop the week of the festival, but Joe and I will see you in person because we're planning on going on Saturday on the show on Saturday to see you and Bobcat.
We can get you to meet Bobcat. We shall.
You know, but this has been fantastic. And like I said, I've been a fan of your comedy before I fell into this. It was an absolute, it was fantastic to, you know, see you and your son at Luna. Like I said, Laura Sims has said nothing but, you know, amazing things about your teaching and your mentoring. So it's just really great how many great people are in this community. And it's great to finally chat with you and everybody that Joe and I work with, like, you know, Jim McHugh yesterday. He's like, make sure you say, I said, hi. John Tobin was the one who gave me your number and said, hey, reach out and tell him I told you to call him. So this it's great. I mean, literally.
If anything else, you find people you can tolerate. That's what happens.
I think you just described mine and Joe's marriage. Well, not our marriage to each other, to our wife. But we're more married to each other than our wife. Tony, this was fantastic. Thank you very much. And Joe, I'll give you the last thoughts.
Thank you.
Tony, thank you for coming on. But I'm just filling out the paperwork. What do you want on your tombstone?
What are you looking at?
Perfect. Tony V, thank you so much for coming on our show. And Jacques, don't forget.
But it's not easy. I had a thing the other day. I was thinking about calling my insurance company because I almost hit a boat in my car. See, it only happens to me. Only shit that like that happens to me. I was on the highway. You know, I was doing the speed limit, 85, 90. I look up from my crossword. Well, you can't text and drive. It's very dangerous. But, you know, I just did that thing where I spaced for a second, you know, and I looked up and there's the rear end of a boat in front of me. You know, I came about a half a second away from crashing into the back of a boat, which you would have to explain to somebody, like your insurance company. You know, you'd have to go, I hit a boat. In your car? You go, yeah. What'd you go off a bridge or something? Nope. Just hit a boat. And they would say, what kind of a boat? And I'd say, I don't know anything about boats. But I tell you this, it was pretty powerful. It seemed to be pushing a truck.
Time to talk to you, 'cause all I really have is my mind.